Spoonful of Data.
Hello and welcome to the Spoonful of Data podcast. I'm Will Richmond-Coggan and I'm here with my extremely esteemed colleague, Mona Schradl.
Well, thank you, Will. Will, do you like weddings?
Yes, I've not been to many recently, but yeah, they're always good fun.
I was thinking about weddings in the scenario of the new AI Act that the EU has passed.
Okay.
And it seems like it could be a romantic comedy or it could end up some sort of tragic love story. So the reason that weddings popped into my head was that you get a lot of different parties who have to come together to make it all work, to develop the product, to sell the product, to use the product and be compliant in the way that it's adopted. And where you have one party, at least, who is super rich and the other party isn't, it's useful to think of a prenup before you get married, because at the time where everybody is happy, clappy and so on, it's so much easier to come to a reasonable, amicable framework of what would happen if something will go wrong, as it inevitably will for most people. And when everybody's happy, they're so much more likely to tell you about their account in the Cayman Islands and so on, then later on when they think they've been cheated on and they're like, no, I'm going to screw you for every last penny.
I've got this sort of image in my head now of some sort of meet cute between big tech on the one hand and the EU getting together. And well, I wonder if there's very much romance in it, really. it feels to me like if this is a marriage, it's definitely a marriage of convenience. There's big tech who obviously want access to the marketplace that the EU has to offer. The EU, on the other hand, they probably can't afford to completely turn their back on this technology. But they're being pretty clear that there are only certain rules under which they're going to let them into the house.
Yes, although is that sort of the setup for a romantic comedy as well? I feel like I'm veering off topic. Why do we actually care about the AI Act, Will?
This is the thing, isn't it? Because in a sense, in the UK, we're sitting with our popcorn watching this unfold on the big screen. There would be a temptation to think that maybe it's not directly relevant to us. I think that would be a mistake for a few reasons. And we've talked about this a little bit in previous episodes. Firstly, I think many of the people that are developing AI in the UK are going to want to sell into Europe. It's a big marketplace. I think they would be crazy to just decide that that was an area that they had no interest in broadening out into. Secondly, I think it's one of these things a bit like with GDPR. There's a chance that what the EU does is going to set a gold standard that other places are going to end up having to follow, even if reluctantly. And with the UK having abdicated responsibility for regulating in this area, there's a chance that the EU model is going to fill in the gaps. But I think also, and we'll maybe come back to this a bit later on, but I think there are probably some quite useful pointers within what the EU is trying to do in a formal sort of regulatory way, which actually are just good common sense that everyone could adopt and use in their own way of approaching how they govern AI within their own organisations.
Yeah, there's some really helpful overarching principles that are laid out by the AI Act. And from what I gather, it's not all set in stone yet. There's still some moving parts, but one of the things that I thought it definitely is getting right is the recognition that all AI systems run on data sets and that it's important that those data sets are accurate, because if they're not, that's going to lead to bias, it's going to lead to social harm and so on. And it demands a certain level of transparency, which gets me back to the prenup situation. If people won't tell you at this stage what they've got, they're never going to tell you.
Yeah, that's a really good point. One of the things, actually, you talked about it not being set in stone. One of the things which I gather even now has changed between the version that was approved at the end of last year and the version that's just been voted on by the Parliament in March of 2024, is that it was the case that AI companies that were open source, so where they published all of the detail about the data provenance and the weights that were used in the models and so forth, that all of that would give them effectively a get out of jail free card, that they would be exempt from a lot of the other regulatory oversight. And I gather that the position now, as at March 24, is that's changed, and that simply being an open source AI developer, so having that higher level of transparency that you're talking about, won't be enough in itself to give them that exemption, that they'll still be subject to all of the same regulatory oversight as other developers who are perhaps being a bit more opaque.
And within that, there's a sort of pyramid in terms of risk. Only AI that's deemed really high risk is going to be monitored extremely closely. But the EU accepts that there are AI tools that really aren't very high risk.
Yeah, I think the starting point, the sort of tip of the pyramid, if you like, is those categories of AI, which the EU have decided for the moment are an unacceptable risk. And those, they're banning outright. So before you even get into the ones where there's sort of higher or lower levels of scrutiny, there are some categories of AI which the EU is just saying, well, those are simply going to be prohibited. We'll have to see how that goes in practice, because it does seem to me that in a sense, they're sacrificing the ability to exercise any control over the way in which those types of tools develop. By banning them within that market, I think what they're effectively saying is people can freely develop those elsewhere in the world, and we won't really try and exercise any sort of control over the way in which those evolve. All we're saying is they won't be licensed for sale within the EU.
Yes, whereas what they're proposing to do with the higher risk AI tools of having them subject to ongoing monitoring and almost like a quality stamp where you can be certain that, look, this is a higher risk AI tool, but it has been considered and approved by us and it's subject to ongoing monitoring. From a consumer perspective, that's a really reassuring step to take. I'm wondering how on earth they're going to plan to actually monitor this. It seems to me like an absolute mammoth task. But the idea that somebody does feel responsible for whether what lands on my computer is an acceptable AI risk or not is quite reassuring.
Yeah, I suppose, going back to your sort of wedding analogy, you think about the sort of things that are on your gift list for your wedding. You've got the toaster, you've got the the hair curlers or whatever it is. These are physical products, and they might be sold with a CE mark. And you might be confident as a result that if you plug them into your wall socket, they're not going to catch on fire. You're not going to be electrocuted when you use them. When you've got those physical products, you can exercise control over them at the borders. You can make sure that the sort of shoddy toaster that's been manufactured somewhere else in the world and doesn't have those safety standards can be stopped and turned back at a port or at customs. With software, I do think it's a bit different, and I wonder how in practice they're going to be able to implement this. Now, obviously, there can be sanctions for companies that deploy technology that doesn't have those sort of safety marks, but getting access to that software is going to be easy because the internet is so permeable. And it makes me wonder whether to some extent there is going to be a sort of digital border that starts to be erected around the EU, where they start to police a bit more carefully what technology is allowed in.
I'm just thinking that from my own consumer perspective, I think I'd be willing to pay a little bit more and have something where I feel more confident. And if I feel that way, there must be other people who feel that way. And people are already extremely nervous about AI and data collection and whether systems are biased or not, and whether they create a social divide. So I think what we'll see is that even if the EU bans some certain things, we're not going to see the EU being abandoned. I think we're going to see more of a scenario where customer-driven big companies will just have to do this because that is going to be the more desirable product. It's basically going to be like a designer handbag. And yeah, you could buy the knockoff, but people will know. And if you can afford it, you're going to buy the real deal.
I think when you think of it from the perspective of consumers, I can see that there's the argument that there's just going to be market forces at work here. But it's worth bearing in mind that a lot of what the EU identifies as being high-risk systems are not ones where really the individual who is directly engaging with the technology is going to be the one that makes those decisions about what is chosen and how it's deployed. in their list, there's things like critical infrastructure tools, so something that governs transport, for example, tools that deliver education or do scoring of exams, safety components, healthcare, public services, so things like credit scoring, employment. The people that might be acquiring that technology, they're going to be driven by different considerations. They're often going to be driven by considerations of budgetary constraints, and they're going to be driven by considerations of, well, we're buying this tool because we want to overall make for a more efficient system. At the moment, we're using 100 people in our workforce to do credit scoring. Well, actually, we want to reduce that to 10 people who are reviewing the decisions of an automated credit scoring bot. Now, in that scenario, the driver will be around cost reduction and it will be around efficiency. But, and I suppose this is making the point about the need for regulation, there isn't going to be as big of a concern about, well, will people choose our service? Because there might be a monopoly. This might be a governmental service. It might be something where people, if they want to buy a car through this particular car dealership, they've got to submit themselves to that credit scoring approach.
Which only makes it so much more important to have that prenup in place, because it's, in fact, it is the sort of monopolies that are being created behind the curtain that really concern me. I think when we drill down into it, yes, there are a lot of startups and so on, but ultimately, all these startups are getting hoovered up by a few big name players. Yeah. And while they're being led by people who are responsible and so on, it might all be good and well. But what if you get some sort of crazed person to take over the board and then make nut job decisions about how all the tools are going to be used? And I had to have nobody in mind when I say this.
But this is a very live topic, because in the negotiation around the AI Act, France in particular, Germany as well, but France in particular was lobbying really hard for limited restrictions on some of the sort of general AI models. And in part, they were doing so on the basis of a company, a French company, that they felt was going to be prejudiced, called Mistral. Because they said, here's Mistral, it's developing these tools. It needs to be able to compete on a level playing field with some of the big international companies. And they argued for dilution of rules around that, which would have had the effect of favouring those bigger, large-scale model developers. Well, within days of the Act passing, it turns out that Mistral is getting into bed with Microsoft, and that it's actually going from being a sort of open source plucky outsider rising through the ranks to being part of those very large scale companies that the EU was particularly concerned about being able to regulate. Now, talk about a sort of revelation on the wedding night. This was something that it's difficult to imagine that the French government didn't know about, but the wider EU certainly was somewhat taken aback to find that what they had been sold was really not what was then being presented to them.
It's very difficult. How can anybody do this? I think there should be more players out there and not just the big ones to give more choice to people.
Actually, I think looking at the way in which the AI Act is constructed, it's clear that to some extent, the EU does have that idea of encouraging plurality and giving smaller entities a bit of a leg up. Because in addition to what you were talking about in terms of the different categorizations of risk, it's clear as well that those very large players are also, just by virtue of their size, going to be subject to extra controls, not to mention the fact that they're also subject to legislation like the Digital Services Act that mean that actually smaller players will have a slightly easier run of it to a point. But you're absolutely right that anyone that wants to operate within that market has to be cognizant of the regulatory regime that's going to be operating there.
Yes, even though we're not in the EU, I think our response or recommendation to our clients would be, if you have any intention of selling into that market, you're going to make your life so much easier if you just play by those rules, because then you don't have to have two separate systems for one market and the other market.
And as we talked about right at the outset of the podcast, there's also just some good common sense in there. Some of the things that they talk about in terms of how you manage risk, in terms of the sort of steps that you ought to be taking to ensure that there's proper provenance for the data that you're training your models on. All that just gives you resilience, and it means that whatever comes in terms of future regulation in other jurisdictions, be it the US or China or the UK, you can be confident, I think, that if you're following the sort of model that's set out by the EU, you're not going to go very far astray. There's unlikely to be more burdensome rules that are imposed elsewhere that will catch you by surprise.
Do you think it might also be used as a yardstick for common sense? Because the unregulated market, it's all good and well until something goes horribly wrong, right? And then nobody wants to be the poster child for when it went bad. Bearing that in mind, even if there was no regulation, I think I would be a little bit worried that if you take steps that are clearly high risk and it goes wrong, the courts would criticize you even if there was nothing set in stone.
If you look at some of the obligations that are put on the high-risk systems within the EU, these are not things that I think a court would have any difficulty in finding were good sort of common sense risk-based precautions that any developer should put in place. So things like logging of training activities so that results can be properly audited, making sure that the data sets are high quality, making sure that there's appropriate human oversight to minimize risk. And one that we talk about quite a lot, making sure that the developer is actually giving clear and appropriate information to the people that are going to be deploying the technology so that they support them. This is how this is meant to be used. And these are the sort of constraints about ways in which it might be misused. And that latter point, it's something that everyone developing AI needs to be really conscious of, that just because you set out to build a tool to do one particular thing, it's important to recognize that these are very powerful tools and with probably not necessarily an awful lot of work could easily be co-opted into a very different purpose.
It's the poor scientist who developed the atom bomb, right? That's not what he thought he was going to develop, and it all went wrong. And we've been talking about this outside of the podcast before, that doctors, people working in financial institutions, lawyers, they're all subject to a sort of ethical code and have to sign up to a professional body that monitors their sort of moral compass, if you like. I'm starting to think that developers of AI software should probably be equally governed by a sort of ethical guide. And I suppose that's not for this podcast, but we might touch upon that again in the next podcast, which I think, if I can leave everyone with a little preview, is going to be on deepfakes.
Yes, and that's an area where you can certainly see the capabilities of the technology being used for purposes that, well, they're probably different to what people imagined they were going to be used for. But I wonder if they're very different from what they should have imagined. And I think that that point, which brings us back to the topic we keep sort of harping on about, is about identifying practically what are the risks that are represented, to the extent that the EU AI Act is something which is really all about prioritizing dealing with the biggest risks and actually guarding against those, but creating a space within which lower risk applications can be developed and built, provided that there's some transparency around them in a way that can actually be beneficial to society. That feels like a very sensible way in which to prioritize their activities.
I think that draws us to a close for this week's episode.
Yeah.
If you would have any thoughts on what we discussed, you can reach us on social media at A Spoonful of Data. Or by email?
Yes, you can email us at spoonfulofdata@proton.me. So as Mona's already said, we will be back next week talking about deepfake technology. Join us then for another Spoonful.
Goodbye for now.